Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is episode 85 of the Intercooler Podcast. I'm Dan Prosser, here as ever with Andrew Frankel. Now, Andrew, this is a very special episode of the Intercooler Podcast for two reasons. The first is that the podcast now has a sponsor.
Yay!
So I'd like to welcome to the Intercooler family, JBR Capital.
Yeah, it's great news for us. JBR Capital, for people who don't know them, they provide specialist finance for people who have supercars, classic cars, interesting cars. Not only do they do that, what I think particularly drew us to them is they don't do anything else. Okay, it's not just one of the things that they do. That's all they're in business to do. And they're a great bunch of petrol heads. We just got talking and we want to do stuff with them and vice versa. And this sponsoring this podcast just seemed to be the most interesting and effective way of doing that. So yeah, we are delighted because this podcast, as you say, has been going for 85 episodes and it's just been you and me. And now that we have yet another like-minded partner on board. And that's the thing about this is we just don't partner up with people because we can. We partner up with people because we think they fit. And if you look at the other people that we partner with on the app, you know, people like British Automobile Racing Club, Footman James, Gold Track, you know, these are all very much like-minded individuals. And to their number, we can now add JBR Capital. And their job is to, you know, help us continue to do this podcast, hopefully do different things with it, as indeed we're going to do today. And yeah, it's just great to have them on board. And yeah, it's, you know, hopefully it's the start of a new chapter for this podcast.
Yeah, welcome JBR Capital. And it's important to say the company's not just geared around very high-end, very expensive cars. The smallest amount it'll lend is 25,000. The average is 80,000 pounds. It's no surprise really, but The manufacturer whose cars it funds most often, it's Porsche.
Who could have guessed
that?
But
it doesn't have to be a Porsche. So we're very pleased to have them on board. You'll find JBR Capital on Instagram, at JBR Capital, and online, jbrcapital.com. I'll put the links in the description of this podcast as well. Their motto, if you like, is fund your passion, which says it all, really. They get it. They are like us. So if you're looking to fund your next car purchase, just go and check out JBR Capital. Okay, good. Let's move on then. To mark the start of our partnership with JBR Capital, this episode of the podcast, we're talking about supercars. We're going to discuss a couple of supercars that we've been driving recently. And we're going to talk about supercar ownership as well. Andrew, I know you've owned a handful of exotic cars over the years. I haven't. But to give this episode of the podcast some actual credibility, we've roped in a guest, a friend of ours, also our business partner in the Intercooler, a guy who has owned more sports and supercars than most car journalists will ever drive. His name is RSDriver00 on social media, if you want to go and find him. We also call him Richard, because that's his real name. Richard, welcome to the podcast. Am I allowed to call that wonderful lineup of cars you've got at home a collection?
Hi, Dan, Andrew. I guess it is a collection. I tend not to call it that just because I buy cars I like to drive, and collection just sounds a little pompous or a little formal, but it's hard to deny that's what it is, I guess.
What's the distinction, Andrew, between a collection and a whatever else we could call it?
It's the reason you get them. Collectors buy cars to collect. Drivers buy cars to drive. And Richard, as you know, as well as me, is in the business of driving his cars. And the fact that when you go to his... so I'm talking about you, the third person. I'm sorry, Richard, you're on this call. I'm just so used just to talking to Dan. But when we go to your sheds and you can, and everything's on a trickle charger and everything's good to go, and there's always a story about whatever particular car it is has done last. I mean, that's, you know, to me, I mean, I don't have a problem with people who stick cars in sheds and just use them to look at them, but to me, that's not what a car is for. You know, if you want to have something to look at, buy a bit of art and hang it on your wall. And it's great that these things are just, and Richard, you really do use them, don't you? You don't just sort of, you know, wander around the block in them, you know, twice a year on a sunny day just to keep the battery charged up. You go everywhere in them, don't you?
I do. Yeah. And I know you're going to criticize me for some of the things I've sold over the years.
Only one.
If I don't drive them, I tend to sell them, because if it's got garage space or driveway space, it's going to be used. And that, obviously, I enjoy driving. I always have. In a way, it doesn't even matter what it is. I even get some vague satisfaction from driving the family RV around the country.
Yeah, it's interesting that, isn't it? There is something, and I think that, I did a story for Autocar a while back about, I went and did a sort of supercar shoot, but in a Dacia Sandero, for exactly these reasons, just to see how much of the joy of driving was simply the process of conducting a car. And then how much, you know, addition on top of that is, you know, from have a car which, you know, is fast and handles well and everything else. And what I concluded is that so long as the car isn't actively unpleasant in any particular regard, you can have fun in anything. You just got to be in the right environment and the right frame of mind. And that's great. Can I ask you, Richard, is there anything that you really regretted selling? Is there one car you think, I just don't know why I got rid of that?
I was going to say, I never regret anything, because what's the point?
Yeah.
And just move on. On the other hand, yes, there's quite a few cars. And actually, in quite a few cases, I bought them back, sometimes the exact same car. And I go through a very logical process, I think, before I buy and before I sell, but it sometimes lets me down. So there's several, I think, but I currently own... The E46 M3 CSL, I owned one almost from new for quite 7-8 years, sold it, missed it, bought another one. And my CLK Black Mercedes, I sold to a friend, and when he sold it, I couldn't resist buying it back. And I've driven it more, I think, since I bought it back. So the great thing about most cars, you can always find another one if you do make a mistake in selling it.
Right, I just want to jump in and I've got a few questions for Richard myself, but before we get into them, I just want to talk a little bit about your current collection of cars. And just to either impress or disturb you, I just want to see if I can remember every car in your fleet at the moment. So we've poked around your cars a couple of times, but I reckon I can remember all of them. There are quite a few, but I'm going to start with the Porsche shed. So you've got a 356... You've got a 996 GT3 RS. You've got a 997 GT3 RS 4-litre. You've got a Carrera GT. You've got a 911R. You've got a 991 GT3 RS, which I think you share with a friend. You've also got a McLaren 675 LT, and you've got a Jaguar E-Type with some Eagle bits. And there's one missing from that shed that I can't remember. I'll come back to that one. You've recently replaced the Vanquish convertible with an Aston with a V8 Vantage, a manual, which I think is a good move. You've got a Jaguar XE Project 8. You've also got, you've mentioned the E46 M3 CSL. You've got an E30 M3. You've got the CLK63 Black. You've got an NSX R. You have... what am I missing?
You've driven it.
And the CS, the 3.2 Club Sport.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, the M635, which I don't think was here when you were here.
Ah, of course. Yeah, I've not seen that one yet.
Yeah, and the 993.
That's right. And then you've got a couple of other bits as well. You've got a GI Yaris and a Transporter and a Tesla and so on.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't miss out the VW Transporter because that's a great car.
It's the most important one. Okay, I got most of them. That wasn't bad. But the point is, I just wanted to demonstrate to people listening that your collection is full of just interesting stuff. You haven't just tried to line up all the latest and greatest, fastest, newest supercars. That's not really what you're into. I think what the cars you have, it demonstrates a sort of a level of taste and, you know, appreciation for the driving experience. And you've got lots and lots of different driving experiences in there. You've got classics, you've got very modern cars, and you've got everything in between. Roughly, and I think you keep a close track of this sort of thing, roughly, how many of this sort of car have you owned over the years?
In, you know, being a sort of numbers guy, in total, including a few company cars along the way, 111. That includes race cars as well.
Wow, roughly 111. Well, precisely. Okay, well, let's talk about the sort of appeal of having a... It's a significant collection of cars. It's not the biggest. Rather than sort of two or three that you really love, do you just enjoy being able to dip in and out and having lots of different experiences in your garage?
Yeah, there's a sort of logic in what I own. I mean, the theory is I try and own something that has a unique experience or a unique aspect to it. So I don't want to have a load of cars that do the same thing. Of course, there is quite a lot of overlap, as you can tell from the list. But that's sort of the logic. The other thing is it often takes me quite a bit of time to appreciate a car. So I don't very often buy new cars, actually. I tend to get them a few years after or even many years after they came out, either because in many cases I couldn't afford them when they came out, or they just didn't somehow appeal, and then something clicks and you see it, read about it. One of you guys writes something, whatever it might be, and I end up buying it. But it is absolutely about something that I love. I like an aspect of it. Could be a design aspect, could be an engineering aspect, but absolutely it's got to be good to drive. And one of the pleasures, actually, for me is sharing the cars with friends and getting them out and taking them on the road.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that in a moment because we did do that recently. Andrew, I know you've been gagging to ask about one car in particular.
Yes, could you tell us why you sold your LFA, please? This is something that I've... So Richard had a Lexus LFA, and if I had an LFA, I guess it's probably down to what you're talking about. But about cars have to have a purpose, and it's not enough to. And I have, you know, the number of cars I've owned pales into insignificance in both quality and quantity compared to yours. But even I have owned cars whose role in my life becomes one of just making me feel guilty about not using them. And I see them there in the shed. I can remember once I had a 993 Carrera RS, beautiful car, 95 car. And I remember getting into it in one spring and finding the clock was still set to British summertime. And thinking, well, that's not what this car should be for. So I don't know, but you did have an LFA, which is to me one of the all-time great cars, and you don't anymore.
Yeah, you make me feel quite bad now, actually. I have to say, that is the car, when I sold it, I got the most flack from my mates of any car I've ever sold. And it is a wonderful engineering feat. And certainly if I showed it to anybody, and it's a brilliant thing to show off, and, you know, the carbon fiber bonnet stay, and just, it was just a wonderful thing. But I used to walk past it and I'd drive something else. And it, partly the sort of journeys it's good for, long, well, GT, transcontinental journeys, it was quite rare for, and you knew that if something went wrong, you'd never find anybody local to replace it. If you're out in a 911, something drops off, there'll always be somebody somewhere who can help you put it back together. And I loved it for what it was, but I didn't love it for driving. And I got a call from somebody who knew I had it, and it was a sort of maybe an offer I couldn't refuse, really. And when I really sat down and thought about it, didn't drive it enough.
Fair enough. That's the reason, isn't it, for selling it? If you don't drive it enough, you know, sell it to someone who will.
Can I ask, in a similar vein, Ford GT. Now, I borrowed your Ford GT for a magazine photo shoot a few years ago. Special thing, but so why did that not stay? Just because, again, it wasn't being used?
I have to be a bit careful with that one. I was very privileged to get one, because you had to go through a sort of vetting process, and goodness knows how I passed it. But I'd had some association with the race team in Le Mans, and I loved the fact that it was literally a Le Mans car for the road, as you know. So it was a privilege to get it, and it's one of the new cars I bought. I went out to the factory in Toronto to see it on the line, and it was really special for that. And actually, I loved it. I did 1,000 miles in it, half of that on track, and I really enjoyed it. But the ownership experience wasn't brilliant. Ford, I love Fords. I've had Fords over the years, but I worried that a few years down the road, it'd be hard to get parts. And the values, I don't buy cars as investments, but I do like to think about capital protection. And there's no Ford GTs, even the previous gen, if you look at them, most of them have delivery miles. And I just thought, if I'm going to use it, I'm going to get killed on it, and I'm just not sure in how it's going to be for the long term. So I enjoyed it, had 2 years of it, and sold it.
Here you go. This is the sort of insight you only get from someone who actually buys and sells these cars and uses them and drives them.
Can I also ask you, Richard, that, you know, we've been through the list of cars that you have and spoken about one or two that you no longer have. For somebody who has, if we can put them under the sort of broad umbrella term of supercars, there's one name that isn't in there, and it is the most blue-blooded supercar manufacturer of them all. You don't own a Ferrari. Have you owned Ferraris? Is there something about Ferraris which, you know, keeps you away, or what is it?
I've owned a few, actually. My favourite, I had a 550. It was of that era, though, when you started it. You smiled when it started, and you just waited to see which warning light came on. It only once let us down, actually, and it turned out to be a very, very minor thing. Luckily, it let us down in Italy, so we found somebody who could mend it. Probably my favourite is the 599 GTO, which I owned.
Wow.
And had the privilege to drive that to Maranello and take it round Fiorano. And I have to say, next to the F12s that were there, I thought it was head and shoulders above. I've owned a few other mid-engine V8 ones. I think for me, they're loud in every sense. Ferraris, they're very visible and they're very loud on the road. And the modern ones, I always end up driving them and thinking, I prefer to have a 911. And the ownership experience of, you know, just trying to get hold of the modern ones is really difficult. And I really don't want to buy half a dozen regular Ferraris in order to get the special one.
I wanted to ask about that, actually. Are you just not interested in being part of that game?
No. No, it's too much hassle. And I think I'd rather pay a premium for, if there's a car I really want, one doesn't like paying a premium, but that's the market. I'd rather buy that one car and pay the premium than own a bunch I didn't really want to have in order to get that special one. But I really admire Ferraris for what they are, and I friends have them, and I'm privileged to drive them. I always enjoy the drive, but just not enough to replace. Because I'm absolutely into now one in, one out. I didn't used to be, because it's a bit more spare. I had a storage place I could use. But now it's like, if I'm replacing something, something else has got to go. Or I've got to be able to squeeze a few more into the same space, which I have done so far. So it's not that rigid.
So how do you use your cars then? I mean, how many track days do you think you do in a typical year, not in a COVID year? How many driving holidays do you manage to squeeze in, that sort of thing?
I try and do all the destination Nürburgring days. So that's 3, 4, 5 days on track. And obviously our friends Gold Track do some brilliant days, particularly Silverstone. So I probably get to Silverstone similar number of times a year. And then the odd other one or two, if I can squeeze it in. So I love track days. I've done a bit of racing, not to Andrew's standard, I think it's fair to say, but I do enjoy a bit of racing.
I met you for the first time at a racetrack. We were both freezing to death in Anglesey, and you were, I was always impressed with the fact that quite clearly you could have raced anything that was there, and you were in a Citroen C1, which I just thought was beautifully understated. And we were doing it for Mission Motorsports, and I can't remember how long ago it was. It must have been 3 or 4 years ago, I guess. But yeah, you were up there racing, and it was a cold but a good weekend.
Yeah, but it doesn't really matter almost what you're racing. Particularly, I've done a few of the 24-hour C1s, one make series, so it's about, again, the driving, not the car. But so I do enjoy track days, and it's as much the people you do it with. I mean, our Thruxton track day was great fun. We had a few friends there, and it's a great circuit, but to me, it's always about who you're with. And then road trips, I have a good group of friends, and we'll do half a dozen if we can, if not a little bit more. It could be a long weekend. Go down to the Ardennes for a long weekend is a fantastic trip, or a bit longer. This year we did Spain. I did Spain for the first time. And you really can get the cars out, and we share our cars quite often. Properly insured, obviously, but we share them, which really adds to the fun. And that, for me, I'll drive them around locally, and I will do on a Sunday morning. Dawn raid on a Sunday morning is always great fun. But those long trips, something special about getting off the train on into France and really being able to stretch the legs.
Yeah, absolutely. So Richard is generous with his cars. And so me and Andrew, we went over to his place a couple of weeks ago, actually to have a meeting about the intercooler, a very positive meeting about the intercooler. There'll be some news soon. But of course, we couldn't go all that way and not have a blast in a handful of cars. Andrew, do you want to pick up the story? Do you want to tell the listeners which cars we chose?
Yeah, I mean, this basically comes down to, and talk about first world problems, me spending years whinging about never having driven a Carrera GT. And it just so happens that Richard not only has one, but is, for some reason best known to Richard, prepared to make it available to idiots like us. And then we just kind of decided what else we were going to take along. There are three of us, so we thought we might as well take three cars. And as is so often the case, you just end up in Porsches, don't you? Because they work. And also, I won't call it a collection. Richard's accumulation of Porsches is so extensive, you can actually choose three completely different Porsches. So one was obviously the Carrera GT. And at the other end of it, we took his very well used, but still somehow, you know, rattle-free, beautifully built Club Sport 911. And in the middle, well, we just, you know, he's got a 4-litre, you know, 997 GT3 RS, so we thought we might as well take that as well. So we just went off for this very sort of impromptu, informal, quick sort of run around the roads in these cars. We got a bit wet. Well, I got a bit wet because I was in the Carrera GT when the heavens opened, and we decided we weren't going to take the roof with us. But it was a wonderful thing to do, but it was very interesting to me to see how different those cars is, and yet how the same they are too, and how they still all feel like Porsches despite being so different. And also, what a thing a Carrera GT is. So can yeah, I take this opportunity to thank Richard in public for finally allowing me to tick that box?
So Richard, I'm curious, do you have a favourite car, and is it the Carrera GT?
Yeah, I usually answer that question with, like, people ask you, do you have a favourite child? You'd never admit it, would you?
But you do.
My daughter, who you know, always thinks it's her. She just tells people, I don't, won't tell her the others. But not really, because again, it's horses for courses. Although the Kuro GT is the one I've owned the longest. I've owned it since 2008. I don't ever see that one going at all. And it, in a way, you know, the cars you describe are the sum up almost the ethos of why I own these, because they are all different. And of course, the thing about Porsches is, yes, if you know what they are, they're something. I mean, some people know that the Club Sport is one of 53. Most people just think it's an old white Porsche with silly red wheels, and they don't take a second look at it. And even the Carrera GT, and I said to somebody once, well, it's not flashy, and they sort of raised their eyebrows. The second time I drove that car, I went to fill it up with petrol. A bloke came running up to me in the petrol station and said to me, is that the new Boxster?
I hope you said yes.
But that's what I like about it. As you say, it's just a Porsche. It's got the 996 dashboard, pretty much, hasn't it? And somebody thought it was a Boxster. So you're not necessarily too conspicuous in it.
So let me paint a picture. I'm in the GT3 RS 4-litre. I'd never driven any of these three cars, so it was a big day for me. I'm in the 4-litre, back of the lineup. Richard's tearing off ahead in the Club Sport. Actually, frightening speed. Really getting a move on in that thing. It's one of those weird days where the sun is shining, but it's raining on and off, and the sun is low. So visibility is poor, and we're on a dual carriageway. Andrew's in front of me in the Carrera GT, and it starts raining quite hard. He's got the roof off. I'm thinking, I'm glad I'm in the 4-litre. Right up until I hit some standing water on the Michelin Cup 2 tyres, and the whole thing squirms underneath me, and I think, ooh, I'm not sure about this. But the whole time I was just thinking, I know that right now Andrew's driving a Carrera GT for the first time, and he's going to be just having the best fun. So Andrew, just take a couple of minutes just to sort of describe that car to us.
It was so much about it is so very familiar. And that's, I think, what I really appreciated, because it is just a car. If you've driven any kind of old Porsche at all, or Porsche from that era, it is just something you can get in and drive. The only thing you have to be mindful of is the clutch, particularly when you're sort of pulling away from an uphill junction. But other than that, you know, it's totally accessible. It's not intimidating. And yet, when you start to drive it a little bit quickly, and we couldn't drive super, super fast because, you know, the conditions didn't allow it. But we are, I think, on another date going to, you know, take some of them up to some proper roads, maybe in Wales or whatever. And we'll come back and talk about that trip as and when it happens. But I just found it was just so rewarding and engaging. And more than this, what really surprised me about it is just how fast it felt. Because I guess in the intervening years, we've driven so much fast stuff, haven't we, these days. You can get into some cars which, you know, which are, we would regard as quite normal cars, which by the standards of even 10 years ago would be classified as being outrageously fast. And yet the Carrera GT, with that extraordinary engine, that engine that was created for Le Mans, it just has this relentless quality to it because it's large and it's naturally aspirated, and it just goes and goes and goes. And yeah, it's just one of those experiences that you are aware at the same time of being how lucky you are to have it, and how actually you just want to have a longer, better, faster, you know, more, even more involving experience into it. Because it's one of those cars that, although it's very familiar when you get in and drive it, the more you drive it, the more you feel actually this is a car that's really going to reward a bit of wheel time. And I'm not just saying that so I can drive it again. It's just it is just one of those cars that you really want to learn. You want to get to know. So many cars these days, you get in them and you think, well, it's these are really cool cars, but you know, you kind of feel they wear their hearts on their sleeves. With the Carrera GT, I think if you, the more you drove it, I don't think, maybe Richard, this is why you never sold it, you know, the more you find out about it, I don't think it's a car that will ever be, it will ever feel normal in any way. It was wonderful.
No, that's lovely to hear you talk about it that way. I agree with you. I mean, I've just checked, it's just under 1400 kilos.
Yeah.
600 horsepower, which is nothing compared to sort of other cars today, and not even that much torque, like 430 odd of torque. But there doesn't seem to be any sort of losses in the system anywhere, do they? And it just, all that power uses it to go forward. I didn't choose great roads, and as you say, the weather wasn't good, and we ran out of time, and all of that. So we will go out again. You do need time in that car. And actually, one of the best trips I've had in it is there are a couple of friends of mine also own Carrera GTs, and we went down to Germany to near the ring. We didn't take them on the ring, although the other two have been on before. But the roads around there are fantastic, and just the drive down. And the roads were, they're smooth and relatively empty. And it was absolutely brilliant on that that trip. And in fact, one of the cars I mentioned to you, so a friend of mine has fitted the KW suspension. And I think we're going to do a back-to-back test at some time for you on that. I don't think it needs it. He absolutely thinks it's better. So and he's a better driver than me, so I suspect he's right. But it is a great car. As you say, you can use it. And again, I like that about Porsches. You can use it. And, you know, people do ask, well, you can use it, but aren't you scared to park it? And you have to recognise, you know, it's worth more money than it was when I bought it and so on. But again, I think if you've got a car, if you worry about it like that, you can't use it. And if I'm out and about and it's parked and it's in the street and it's got a tracker, and, you know, I've never had an issue.
I had a fairly short go in it, so I definitely need another go at some point. But the engine is just extraordinary in that thing, a gorgeous engine. I'd heard so much about the tricky clutch. Actually, all you have to do is just pull away without using any throttle. I had a couple of tricky uphill junctions that really had me worried. I was thinking I might have to go downhill here rather than up. I might, you know, just call you and get you to come and drive it for me. But it sort of demands your attention, but it's fine, really.
It's one of those things. It's like having a car with really bad brakes. As long as you know it's got really bad brakes, that's more than half the battle, because you just leave bigger braking distance. And then as long as you know about the clutch and how to draw away, then that's fine. I think you're probably only going to damage it if you don't know.
It's interesting you talk about that, because certainly in the social media and Twitter sphere and so on, there are lots of theories, often from people who obviously haven't driven the cars. But the clutch is the issue, and also how tricky the Carrera GT is. And obviously you were just driving it, you know, legal speeds on the road. But I mean, when Clarkson tested it, he did that deliberate spinning it on every corner. And that's what people remember. And the reality is, on the tires it originally came on, and I think people forget that in the last 15 years, tires have developed enormously.
100%.
It transforms how you can use any car, including the club sport. But on the modern supersports, and I know people put Cup 2s on it, although Porsche don't sort of officially sanction it. I know people who do. It's lost all of that. And I've taken it on track, and I'm not the world's best driver, and it can move around a little bit, as long as you're sensible, pretty easily. The traction control is a vague suggestion of something in a flashing light. It doesn't actually do anything.
I did see it in a straight line.
That warning was ringing in my ears when I drove the car. The club sport is a gorgeous little thing. You mentioned it just now. Most people just look at it and think, oh, it's probably the cheapest 911 the bloke could buy. You know, it just looks like an 80s 911, doesn't it, with red wheels. But it's such a special thing. Gorgeous to drive. I love those seats. And as Andrew mentioned, it does just feel rock solid, that thing. I actually just want to talk about the 4-litre. Again, first time I've driven one. I love the 3.8 GT3 RS. It's one of my favourite cars. I'm sure you've had a go in one, you as well. I know you love that car as well, Andrew. But where do you get to appreciate the sort of added specialness of a 4-litre? I mean, do you need a racetrack? Do you need brilliant, dry, smooth continental roads?
I owned a 3.8 for a bit and bought a 4-litre, left-hand drive one originally, just because. And actually, I think the 3.8 is a better road car. It's a little more supple and just feels a bit better on the road, and the extra power makes absolutely no difference on the road. In fact, a friend and I recently, the beginning of the year, took out his 3.8 versus my 4.0, and I don't know, we're not journalists, couldn't really notice that much difference, if I'm honest. But I think they're equally great cars. And I, to be honest, I bought the 4-litre, I had an opportunity to get the left-hand drive one a good number, and I swapped into the right-hand drive a little while ago. And what I like is back to my capital protection point, they're only 604 litres, and it was the last of the Metzger engine. And as an ownership proposition, I just think it's a good ownership proposition. And to be honest, I'd have a 3.8 at the drop of a hat, but I'm lucky to have the 4 litre.
But you got a 4 litre.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love a 3.8 or a 4 litre. Not fussy. Well, I mean, we're very lucky, Andrew and I, to have a business partner who's so generous with these cars. It's actually a brilliant resource for us. On the intercooler, we can talk about them, we can write stories about them. There will be more to come. So, yeah, I mean, we just need to get through winter, don't we? Wait for the better weather to arrive and find some time to get out to some really good roads. you've got some extraordinary cars in there.
Can I just talk a little bit about the Club Sport? Obviously, I didn't know what to expect when I got in the Carrera GT, and it was terrific. The 4 litre, I know what they're like. I've driven those quite extensively. I've actually driven that generation of G Series 911 with the G50 gearbox, the later G50 gearbox, a fair bit too. But the Club Sport, there's something strange about those Club Sports, because they are, if you look at the spec sheets, yes, they're lightened and they've got limited slip diff in them. They're meant to have blueprinted engines and that sort of thing. But these are all like sort of small changes. And yet you get in it and it just feels, particularly if you drive it against a sort of 4 litre, you know, 997 GT3 RS and Carrera GT, you just think it's going to be the poor relation, don't you? And it's not. It absolutely isn't. And in that regard, it was actually the most surprising of the three to me. And actually, certainly on the roads that we were on, which we've discussed, they were quite busy and it was quite wet and it wasn't, you know, ideal circumstances. It's probably the one that I enjoyed driving the most. I think that is a sensational car. And yours, Richard, yours has done, what, 130,000 miles or something? It's had, you know, most of those on 100, yeah, most of those are loads, tens of thousands of miles on racetracks. And it just feels bulletproof, doesn't it? And I love that. I love that about those cars. It was just a total revelation to me that a Porsche that old and that apparently not so different from anything else could just feel so, so special.
It's something Porsche do really well, isn't it? Because it's still run, or at least, you know, with Preuninger and so on, they're just great people who understand driving. And that car, I think I'm the fourth owner, but the last two are both mates. And as you say, it's spent a lot of time on the ring, But it's a bit of a trigger's broom. And I think with all of these cars, you talk about them being ready to go and on charge and so on, but I get everything serviced every year. And I find people who I trust, and all my Porsches, other than the Carrera GT, are looked after by JZM, and every year they look at it and we do a bit to it. So on that car, I've had the suspension rebuilt. I've obviously had the brakes done, had the engine rebuilt at 125,000 miles, and it just is beautifully done. And so I think it is important to keep these, particularly the older ones, keep them serviced and do what you need to do with them. Because that enables you just to get in and start them and drive them. And I took the Club Sport out just last weekend and did 250 miles, I think, and it's just perfect on B roads. And yeah, brilliant car. But the Cayman R, I thought, was a great car and was quite different to the Cayman S, with very, very little in terms of spec difference. And they just seem to be able to do it.
And on your one-in, one-out basis, if you had to get something, what would go to make space for it? So what would it be, and what would you get rid of?
It sounds terrible, doesn't it? But I if there's something I really have my eye on, I'll sort of do it. So I'm up to speed at the moment, actually, I have to say. I think and with COVID, clearly with the lockdown, I didn't use the cars as much as I wanted, so my real focus now is using them.
So your most recent acquisition, I think, was the M635 CSI.
Well, the Aston.
Oh, apart from the Aston. Yeah, the Aston.
Yeah, you don't really approve of the Aston, I know that. But
I do approve of the Aston. I approve of it more than the one you sold. I think it was definitely, I think that was absolutely a good move. But the M635, it's a terrific car.
Yeah, that when I was in my teens, before I even drove, my father's cousin was really into cars, and he was actually, wasn't clerk of the course, but he was something at Brands Hatch. And I remember him buying a brand new 633 CSI in the day. At the time, my dad had a Austin 1800, I think. So Uncle Peter turned up and turned my head and drove me around Brands, the GP circuit in that, in black car. Always wanted one. Never really found one. Then they were out of favour and they were all sort of rotting away. And this one just came up. Actually, Barney House at Classic Heroes had it, and I've dealt with him before, and it was just there. And low miles, I knew the guy had owned it before, and I bought it, and I just love it. Absolutely love it. But there's always a reason, you know, why they pique your interest somehow, and to get to own it is a privilege. That one I know you need to drive again at some point.
It's a long list of cars of yours that we need to drive. We will do that again at some point. Well, Richard, thank you for coming on and for telling us about the realities of supercar and sports car ownership, an insight that actually, you know, me and Andrew couldn't have offered anybody. So, yeah, thanks for coming on. And we will make use of your brilliant collection of cars, particularly when the weather's better. We'll photograph a few, we'll jump in and out and drive some, and it'll be good fun. So, again, yeah, thank you for joining us. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back to talk to you again next week. And finally, thank you as well to JBR Capital for coming on board as a podcast sponsor. We do appreciate that a lot. At JBR Capital on Instagram or jbrcapital.com online. Go and fund your passion. Thank you both, and we'll talk to you all again next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.